Welcome to Biblical Higher Ed Talk, where we tap into the wisdom of leaders and practitioners of biblical higher education for the advancement of colleges and universities teaching the way of Christ in the modern world. Each week, we'll tackle topics around leading your organization, expanding your impact in the world, and deepening your faith through Christ-centered conversations. Ready to make a difference in the lives of your faculty, staff, and students? Then let's begin our journey.
Today on Biblical Higher Ed Talk, I sit down with Roger Parrott, president of Belhaven University, to discuss the keys to successful presidential leadership. Learn from someone who has a powerful record of leadership success. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm your host, Philip Dearborn, president of the Association for Biblical Higher Education. And we are honored to have as our guest this week, Roger Parrott. Roger has served as the president of Belhaven University in Jackson, Mississippi since 1996, and has established himself as one of America's most experienced university presidents. And the thing is, if you ever get a chance to interact with Roger, he's so incredibly humble and willing to share all of his experiences and what God has taught him along the way. And I've invited Roger in to reflect over his leadership years and capture what he sees as keys to successful presidential leadership. So welcome to the show, Roger. Glad that you're here.
Hey, thank you. Treat to be here because I love ABHE. You know, I'm a huge fan. So I love what you're doing, love what your schools are doing. And this is a joy for me.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. Appreciate it. So we're going to jump into some framing questions and just some of the experiences that you've had over your lifetime of service. But before we do that, to kick off our conversation, as you reflect back over your life, share with us a defining moment that God used that propelled you forward. And you can pick either your professional life or your personal life.
Well, you know, it really was a very specific moment. I remember so well. I'd been in higher ed. I got my PhD in higher ed. My dad, my grandfather, both college presidents. It seemed like a natural path for me. Did the VP thing at a school. And then I went to the Lausanne Committee for World Evangelization. Raised a bunch of money for the 89 Congress. So got to know a lot of people around the country. And knowing that was coming to an end, I thought, well, I'd go into the college presidency. I was 32 years old. That's kind of crazy, but I thought I would. And so started applying, looking at schools. I had some really nice opportunities within the broader Christian world to do some big, huge campaigns and work with some top leaders. But I really wanted to go back to higher ed. And nothing was hitting. Philip, I was getting turned down by schools. I couldn't believe I was getting turned down everywhere. And I'll never forget, my wife and I were on a long walk one night. And we finally just said, you know, we don't have to do this. Let's just commit it to the Lord. Let's forget this. Let's go out west and we're going to plant a church. And that was our dream and desire at that point. We just gave up the college presidency. And within 2 months, I had two offers for college presidency. So I think there's something important for college presidents to not want this job. In fact, I get a lot of people ask me, well, how do you become a college president? Well, and my answer, my question back to them is, do you want to get the job or do you want to do the job? Because a lot of people want to get the job. They think there's prestige, there's title, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you don't love doing the job, you shouldn't be in this business. Find something else to do.
Yeah. Wow. What a story. I often have shared with people, they're desiring to do something. Proverbs 16:9, in his heart, a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. To just open up their hands and allow the Lord to lead in that direction. And when we try to cling on to it, and the Lord is saying, nope, I got this. Don't worry. I got a plan for you and I'm working it out.
It's a lot better than the best one you got.
That's right. Yeah. And I love that perspective too of seeking after the presidency. And it's, people are drawn to the romance of leadership, all of the perks of the presidency. But you've spent a lifetime of doing the hard work of rolling up sleeves and just doing the work of presidency.
I love it every day.
That's awesome. So what we're going to do is kind of reflect back on that and your leadership experiences. And you shared a little bit there that you're a third generation university president. There would probably be no way to figure this out, but it'd be hard pressed to find too many generations of families that three generations have served in the college presidency. So not only did you grow up with it, grandfather was also involved in a presidency. So as a third generation university president, there's been turbulence in higher education. Have we always had that turbulence, or is what we experience today something unique from what three generations of presidents have seen?
This is totally unique. It's not just unique from three generations. It's unique from 10 years ago. I've been in the president's chair for coming up on 35 years. I've never seen a time like this. And it's a number of things. First of all, the margins are thinner than ever. The financial margins are thinner than ever. The hiring market, the number of students, everything is thinner than it's ever been. You just don't get much wiggle room. If you make a mistake, there's not a lot of opportunity to recover. And so I've never seen it like this. I think the time frame to fix problems is tighter than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. We don't have the luxury of, well, we'll get that right next year. No, we need to get it right next month or next week. We just don't have, we used to be able to have fix it over 2 or 3 years. You can't do that anymore. You won't be around if you do. So I think that's a big change. I think another big change is there are just fewer options. It used to be you get in trouble a little bit. Well, we start a new program, but we go find some international students, or, you know, if you're a more of liberal arts like we are, you add another sport or something. We don't have those options in the same way. So there are no easy fixes to any of these things. It's about executing extremely well what God's given you, being extremely efficient in how you do it, and almost never missing. And then I think the fundraising demands are more intense than ever, especially on presidents. And presidents are a tough place for fundraising. That's why from time to time I coach a few presidents on their fundraising, because they're put into this job expected to raise money, but they can't ask anybody really how to do it, because the people they'd ask are their donors, because they're poor and they're supposed to know how to do it. And so not only do they have pressure to do what they're not trained to do, but the other issue is what they need are money for. They don't need money for new buildings and projects. Yeah. They need money just to operate the place. And that's sometimes the hardest money to raise. And you got to get more creative than that. So so those are some of them. You know, to me, the list goes on. I think boards are a lot less understanding of the complexity of what higher education is facing. In fact, I just had my board meet on Friday this week. And I gave my board an illustration. I said, you know, I want you all to understand how dynamic this industry is. And I said, think of it like the television industry. Television used to be a thing that was an event for a few hours a day. The family gathered around the TV. That happened. Well, then the networks came in. They kind of dominated things. You're not probably, you may not remember, but they used to go up at midnight. And, you know.
I do remember that.
Okay. You know, it was a sad time for us on a Friday night when the TV went off. And then local stations came in, and then cable went in, came in, and you had dozens and dozens of channels. And everybody thought, well, that, you know, it's really changed. No, but it kept going. So then the rental thing came on, and I wrote in the book the illustration about how Blockbuster could have bought Netflix for $50 million, and they passed on it because they thought they had it nailed with rentals. People wanted to come into the store. And then we all had VCR machines. We all recorded. Then we built home theaters. You can't even give those away now. And then we got DVRs. And then it's changing again. It's going to individual streaming, binge watching, you know, YouTube. So that industry is changing. And no matter how much the industry changes, the market changes with even faster.
Yeah.
Higher education is facing the same thing. We are in a huge market shift, and we're trying to do what we did 20 or 40 years ago, and it's not working. So we got to do things differently. So, you know, I mean, those are some of the reasons I've got. Those are probably too many already.
So obviously this is not, this is unique. It's not something that has expanded over three decades of presidencies. So how has how you approach leadership shifted or changed in these last 10 years that you've seen this tremendous change in these pressures? How have you changed as a leader?
I just think we have to be a lot faster. I was always fast, but now I'm a lot faster. But you can't be fast within a higher education institution unless you create the culture that's willing to accept that. And that's where schools get in trouble. They do not have the culture to change, the culture to adapt. They are tied to the person who's slowest to want to change. And in doing so, you're not going to be in business. You're not going to make it. So, you know, building a culture that's nimble, a culture that's willing to adjust, a culture willing to take on new things without it being a big deal. I mean, for me, that took a lot of years to build. And I'm seeing schools now trying to do that post-COVID because they've got to, but they've still got the culture of 10, 20, 30 years ago, and they can't make the changes because the faculty are kicking back or the board's kicking back or whatever it may be. And what we used to love is what we love. We don't love that new thing. Well, if you don't have the new thing, you're not going to do what you used to love. And so that's where they're really stuck. So I think to me, probably my coming out of COVID, I've gotten a lot faster. I've gotten a lot more focused on what really moves the dial. And as a president, that's probably my biggest priority is what can I do every day that moves the dial? If I'm doing stuff that's not moving the dial, the time is too short. So I'm not going to a lot of the stuff I used to go to. I'm not showing up at all the events I used to go to. I'm not going out to all the places I used to go. There was a lot of activity, but it didn't move the dial. Yeah. I'd rather be ready for the two or three times a week when I can dramatically move the dial than being so worn out from running around to a whole bunch of stuff. It doesn't make any difference.
That takes some pretty serious discipline because, you know, a lot comes to the presidency, the town and gown elements, the relational pieces. And a lot of times we fool ourselves into thinking if we're just busy with those things, we're being an effective president.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of demands from people. You have to change expectations of people that you're not going to do that. You know, you have to set that tone, but then you better produce the results because otherwise they're not going to be happy, you know? When I came to Belhaven, we made it real clear to the board, we don't entertain. You're not coming to our house. If you don't bring a pizza, help yourself. But other than that, you're not coming to our house. Yeah. And I don't do that. A lot of presidents do. I think it's a negative more than a positive. But you have to set the expectations of what that is. You know, if I've got a president friend who told me one day, he said one of his board members got after him because he wasn't at the women's basketball game. Well, you know, if you're going to set the expectation, you're going to show up everything, that's all you're going to get done. Yeah. And the problem is not that you don't have time. The problem is you're so tired, you won't make good decisions on the things that really take rest as part of your job. That is part of your job, to have your mind cleared, your spirit rested, and to have the thinking time you need to deal with the things that really make the difference. I mean, in this job, you're going to make or break your year probably on 7 or 8 decisions a year. And getting those 7 or 8 right is just critical, absolutely critical. You can't afford to miss, again, because the margins are so thin.
Biblical Higher Ed Talk is sponsored by ABHE, the Association for Biblical Higher Education. At ABHE, bringing the love and light of Christ to the world is reflected in our drive to see our member institutions flourish, leading them to a time of success for their institution and giving them the tools and insights they need to look toward the future. Interested in learning more about membership with ABHE? Visit us at abhe.org or send us an email to membership@abhe.org. ABHE is your partner committed to advancing biblical higher education for kingdom impact. Now, back to the show.
A lot of wisdom there. We could probably fill a couple episodes talking about each one of those different things. A lot of it is being comfortable in who you are, how God has created you with your gifts, talents, and abilities, and what you bring to the table. And I think there was also a neat connection there to make sure that with your board, there's clear expectation between the president and the board as to what the board expects the president to do, and the president being clear with the board, this is what you've hired me to do.
Critical, and it needs to be written. I do every year of my board what I call an evaluation conversation. It's not an evaluation, and it's not a feel-good. It's an evaluation conversation where essentially I take the goals for that we had set together, the board and I had set together for my personal priorities, not the institutional priorities, for my personal priorities, what we set last year, and I give accountability on each of those goals, and then together we set accountability goals for the coming year. Now, they 99 times out of 10 take exactly what I give them, but they'll tweak it a little bit or they'll move the priorities on them a little bit, and that's good. But the other thing I do that I think is part of the reason why I've lasted as long as I do have is that every board meeting, I give the board an executive session without me in the room. And then I come back in and they do an executive session with me. And what that does is it helps the board to be very frank and direct about where you're missing it. If presidents will do well and survive if they will periodically take that guidance and direction or criticism. The problem is they wait until it blows up because they never get the board a chance to discuss it. And then there's a mess. And then, you know, the president of ABHE's got to come in and try to, you know, help the board to understand that it's hard to get new presidents when you fire presidents. But we've got to take purposely leadership in that as presidents, because especially for good presidents, and there are a lot of good presidents, but the problem is the board will say, oh, no, we don't need to do that. We just did that last year. And I say to my board, yeah, you do. We need to do it again this year.
Yeah.
And we do it every single year. And I think it really makes a difference.
So you've recently written a book, Opportunity Leadership, and I had you in to our annual meeting a couple years ago, and you actually shared one of the plenary sessions on Opportunity Leadership, the book, and the setup for it is kind of humorous that we had just gone through a strategic planning process and talked to the membership about strategic planning. And your book, you basically say, strategic planning, throw that thing out. You got to be all about opportunity and leadership. So it's game changing. It's a provocative book and has become for me personally and how ABHE approaches how we plan. Isn't it a dangerous thing to suggest to especially institutions of higher education that they throw out their strategic plan?
Well, first, Philip, your introduction was the single best ever in the history of my life of keynote events. So thank you for that, because I didn't need to say anything after that.
That's right.
Yeah, planning doesn't work, long-range planning. And I'm talking about destination planning. I'm not talking about operational planning. Yes, we do operational planning, but predicting futures and predicting destinations, I don't know where Belhaven will be 5 years from now. I don't know how many students we'll have. I don't know what new programs we'll have or which ones we'll cut. We trust opportunities for that, but we plan very well what we do. So it's dangerous if you think, well, I'm not going to plan at all. Yes, you need to plan what God's already given you, but don't try to predict God's future destination. Look for opportunities. I just met a few minutes ago in my office a potential faculty member for a new program that we're starting. It couldn't be more perfect. That's God's opportunity to bring in the right person to us for the right moment at the right time. And we have to look for those opportunities. And so, you know, what I really encourage is it's a mindset, it's an outlook, it's a culture, it's a theology of really trusting in God for our future. We all preach it, but we don't live it very good because we have our long-range plans because we think that's how a president has to operate. After the book came out, I had one president call me and he said, I stayed up all night reading your book. And for the first time in my life, I don't feel guilty. I don't have a long-range plan.
Yeah.
And so, it pushes pretty hard on this concept of giving up long-range planning and letting that go. Now, that's hard for institutions. If you do that overnight, you're going to get fired. Don't do that. The book kind of lays out a process for how you go about it. But there's so many bad things about long-range planning, and it takes so much energy. I have not attended one long-range planning meeting for over 20 years, and it's fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. Is this something that you grew into? Because you became president at what age? 32?
I think 32 or 34, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty young.
34, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So 34 years old coming into the presidency.
Let's put it this way. 20 years I did traditional long range planning. I had the blue ribbon committees. We did the whole thing. We had the five goals that I can tell you before your committee even meet. We came out with all the stuff and we did the whole thing. It doesn't work. And I just got to the point where I realized it doesn't work. And the trigger point was when I came to Belhaven, we were in trouble with our accrediting association. One of the issues was over planning. I had President Samford, Tom Quartz, offered to come over and spend a half day with me, which he did. Brought his vice president of planning We spent a whole half day on working on that and some other issues. And with his vice president of planning in the room, he says, you know, I don't think one significant thing that's ever happened at Samford we planned. They all came by opportunities. And for me, that flipped the switch, and I never looked back after that. Wow. I just had to figure out how to do it. And that's why I wrote the book, because nobody else had been doing it that way, and I wanted to help others find the way to get free from this albatross of long-range planning.
So you share the story in the book, and I'd love for you to recount it, going to one of the first board meetings under this opportunity leadership mindset, and you kind of set it up with the board to say, okay, these are the things that we have accomplished. Go ahead and tell that story.
Oh, it was so fun because we'd gotten into it. We were into it for a few years. And I thought, you know, I need to show them that this works. And they bought in. We didn't have a plan, but I took them a paper and it said five-year plan on the top. And then I started to go through it, and it was like 73 items or something. But it had like growth, 43% in enrollment, 21% of fundraising, 31 million building, 7 new undergraduate majors, 8 graduate majors. I mean, it was this huge stretch. And when I got to the end and I said, you know, this isn't the plan for the next 5 years. This is what we actually did the last 5 years. But the deal is, if I had brought this plan 5 years ago, we would have cut down by 2/3. We would have prayed for God to bless it. We would have hit it, and we would have said, well, look what God did. But by not having a plan, it just went through the roof. And I did that exercise again about 2 years ago, and it was even more dramatic than that. It was remarkable what God's done by living by opportunity.
I love that story. Talk to us about the critic who's going to look at this, though, and say, you're just letting presidents off the hook, right? So they just don't have to do any sort of planning. By saying that they should throw out their strategic plan, we just sit and wait for the Lord to give us the direction.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the model we use is we want to be a sailboat prepared to catch the wind of God when God's wind blows, or the power boat that goes where we think God wants us to go and ignores the wind. And if you know anything about sailing, there is a ton of work that goes into sailing, of preparation, of culture, of listening, of learning, all the kinds of things. So when God's wind blows, you can go with it. Where a power boat to get in and go, turn the motor and off, go. Operation. The one is a lot further than the other. So there's a whole bunch of culture building. There's bringing people into the process. There's creating the anticipation. There's providing the results. All that works what presidents need to be doing, but they don't do that because they're leaning on the planning process to solve everything. It doesn't solve everything. It makes it worse. It doesn't make it better. And so you've got to deal with that critic. And I would just ask them, what about the previous planning processes push this institution forward? What made the big difference? They won't be able to find an answer because it's not in the planning.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So well said. So this is a bit of an unfair question to you, because it's forcing you to kind of reflect back over your experiences there at Belhaven. You have been a very successful president, and sometimes it's difficult for people to talk about their successes, especially when they're humble leaders like you are. So I'm asking you to kind of put that aside a little bit. And as you reflect back over your years of service, distill for us your top three reasons why you've been so successful at Belhaven.
There's a whole bunch of people doing it, but I happen to have the corner office. I think it's, if I pick three, one is I do have the ability to look over the horizon. I can see what's coming. I lived anticipating the future. I live anticipating what the future problems are and what the future solutions are that are needed. I never go into a board meeting without every question answered the board could ask before they ever ask it. And seeing what's coming, because I do have a different perspective, and I help my team see that so we can rally around this. I think that's one. It's a unique gift God's given me that I'm thankful for.
Which, if I can interrupt you there, it connects to really what we talked about at the top of prioritizing how the president spends his or her time. That if you're just filling it with busy activities, you don't have the margin. You'll allow the tyranny of the urgent to just take over. But because you are efficient with your time and prioritize your time, you have the margin to be able to position yourself looking to the future, anticipating the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you don't get your mind separated from the institution enough to do that, you can't see. One of the most significant changes we ever made, I came up with on the tee box at number five on the golf course. I remember very well the moment as I was teeing up the ball and it hit me and it all came clear. Yeah. Like, yeah, there it is. But, you know, you don't get that if you're grinding. And
yeah.
Grinding doesn't necessarily get you more. It yeah. makes you feel better, like you're putting all into it, but it doesn't necessarily get you further down the road. So, yeah, that I think that's critical. You've yeah. got to get the right mindset, which has to do with your schedule. This job will take as much as you'll give it. So you have, as a president, you got to put up a boundary. You got to say where you stop and where you don't do it. And so, and it's different for every presidency, where those boundaries are. But I think that's one to see over the horizon. Probably another one is that I empower people. I've got a good team. I think I hire really well, get good people, and I pay them well and let them do their job. Sometimes my wife will say, well, if you did it, it'd be better. Well, yeah, it'd be better. But first of all, I can't do it because I can't do it all. And secondly, somebody gave me the chance to do it because that's why I could do it better now because I got a chance to learn how to do it before. So when somebody gave me the chance. So I want to empower people and I always want to be what I call future focused evaluating of them. So when they make a mistake, and yeah, they do at times, we're not beating them up for that and trying to put reins on them and trying to hold back. We're trying to empower them for success going forward. But I wrote a whole chapter in the book about how strongly I feel about that. So I think that's why, if I pick the third one, and this thing took a long time to develop it, it'd probably be learning to love roadblocks. Most of us in leadership, once we hit a roadblock, we felt, okay, it's my turn, and we're going to bust through, and we're just going to make it happen, because that's going to prove I'm a leader. No, when you hit a roadblock, what's God saying? That's time to stop and look and evaluate and see if God's protecting you or preparing you for something else or changing direction. And learning to love roadblocks, I think, was probably the hardest thing for me to do because I'm going to go fix it. I'm going to push through. And the roadblocks are sometimes God's most important ways of guiding and directing us and protecting us from things. Yeah.
And it may very well be that you hear from God that you push through that roadblock.
And could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
could be. And then there have been times I've done that. And and you do push through. And that's the only way you could go. And it needs to happen. And it takes a skill and a finesse to do that. And there are times for that. But when I do hit those roadblocks, my first question is always, okay, what's God saying in this? What's God trying to tell me? And I want to listen and make sure I'm hearing it and getting wisdom at those points. Because again, presidents tend to be pretty hard charged. They all run different styles, but most of them tend to be pretty hard charged. Yeah. It's easy to just keep going.
Yeah. Just curious, in your own personal life, your own spirituality, is there a particular spiritual discipline that you practice that you pull away and intentionally hear from God?
I like to get where I can talk out loud to the Lord.
Okay.
So I got a little fishing boat, a little inshore deal, and I can talk out loud on that boat. I can talk out loud on the golf course because I play golf by myself. I don't like to play with people. And I guess that's a weird spiritual discipline. But
hey, if it works.
It works for me.
Yeah, if it works for you, then go for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Roger, we're coming up towards the end here, and we have about a minute left in our episode. So just close us out. You have an audience of leaders in biblical and Christian higher education. What's, as you reflecting back over all of your experiences, what's one parting word of encouragement that you'd like to leave with them?
I guess the one thing I'd leave them is this. You got the best job in the world. You know, don't complain. Don't be beat down. Don't wear the burden on your shoulder. No, it's not lonely. No, they pay you better than you probably ought to deserve. An opportunity to transform lives of students and faculty and people you work with. You got one of the best jobs in the world. And I think what I hate more than anything is I get with a group of presidents and they're complaining and griping about how tough they've got it. No, you don't. You've really got a great thing. My grandfather always said, who's college president, he said, it's the best job in the world as long as you can pay the bills. And that is the truth. If you can make the money work, then this is the best job in the world. If the money's too tight, this really is a pretty rough place to be. And goes back to some of those problems we talked about at the beginning. But, enjoy the privilege God's giving you. Serve the people with the opportunity to make things happen quickly and fast and easy. How can you make their life better? You know, I've always felt like if I can empower a faculty member to do what God's gifted them to do, I don't have to motivate them. They're going to be fine. I just need to give them what they need and get out of their way. And the same way with our financial aid people. They're on the front line of ministry. Help them, encourage them. What are the things that I can do as a president? And those things are all a joy to do. And so, you know, I would just encourage presidents and leaders to just enjoy what God's gifted you to do for the privilege of what he's given you to do. Not many people get to do this. And a lot of people want to.
Well, thank you for the encouragement that you have been to me personally. I often talk about people needing mentors that are close in their life and then mentors that are further out. And you've been one of those. I've only had a couple of occasions to interact with you, but every time I feel like I'm learning a lot about leadership and even my approach. So thank you for playing that role in my life, but also countless others through your scholarship, through the books, and just the example that you are to many of us. So thank you for joining us.
You're so kind, Philip, and I'm so glad for your leadership and what you're doing. ABHE is really, really important to us. We need you to be strong and successful.
Amen. Amen. So until next time, stay kingdom focused.
Thanks for listening to Biblical Higher Ed Talk. For more, follow or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform. We're delighted that you chose to spend a part of your day with us and encourage you to reach out to us with feedback, topics, or guests for the show. You can get in touch with Philip, your host, via LinkedIn or at biblicalhighereddtalk@abhe.org. Biblical Higher Ed Talk is a production of the Association for Biblical Higher Education in association with Westport Studios. Views expressed on this show are those of the participants and may not reflect the views of ABHE or Westport Studios. Bring light and life to your biblical higher educational organization by inquiring about membership with ABHE at abhe.org. We'll catch you next time.